when Google recruited me, it was a good chance for me to really learn how a good company should work in the US, like building things to scale versus just running as hard as you can. That you also want to think through the whole platform and to build something that's solid and to last.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you're just running at a million miles an hour, you just don't stop to do those things. And so it's good to kind of take both. The lessons from China were always, it's better to go fast than to get every single thing right. And that's a big part of like, should be US startup culture. But often because, you know, we grew up with companies that are concerned about headcount and budgets, we don't actually do that. I think what you learn more in the US culture is how to build things to really scale.
Hey, climbers, welcome back to another episode of Climb by VSC. I'm your host, Jay Kapoor, general partner of VSC Ventures and co-host of Climb. Every week on this show, we speak to investors, founders, and industry experts about building and scaling companies in climate tech. My guest today is Eric Rosenblum, who's a managing partner of Foothill Ventures, an early stage fund that backs, among many things, exceptional technical founders and immigrant founders. So lots for us to dig into today. Eric, before all that, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
I know. And we've, you know, corresponded over email and you know, Zoom, and it's good to finally be in person.
Yeah. And we were just talking before this, you know, obviously Vijay and I go way back.
Yes.
And it's good to know the firm, and it's fun to grow things together. So this is
absolutely
great.
Well, before we kind of go too far in, I love to offer people the kind of back of the baseball card on Foothill Ventures. So tell me about the fund, the stage that you invest in, the check size, kind of the basics so folks know what we're talking about here.
Yeah. So we're a small early stage fund, about $250 million under management. So we're getting to be like an established position.
Yeah.
But we still firmly are entrenched in the world of going early, first institutional check.
Got it.
We're very broad. We invest in software, life sciences, and what we call deep tech, which has spikes around energy, battery storage, also semiconductors. We're probably among the most active seed stage investors in both batteries and semiconductors in North America.
Yeah.
And typically we'll write, say, a $1.5 million check into something like a $5 million seed round. And about 90% of the deals we do are between $8 million and $18 million pre-money, to give you a sense.
Yep.
We're based in Los Altos, California.
Yeah.
But I'm now spending 6 months a year in New York City.
So. I know. I want to dig in on that too, because I mean, I've been in the New York ecosystem 14 years now and gotten to see it kind of come up. And so I'm so excited to dig in with you on what draws you and attracts you to this city. But no, super helpful to hear the context. Let's talk a little bit about you. How does a guy from kind of middle of nowhere town in Ohio who hasn't seen the ocean until he was 18 years old end up running a payments company in Shanghai?
Yeah. Like,
give me the background there.
Yeah, it's funny because my kids are now both in college, and that explains part of why I'm here. They're both at NYU.
Nice.
And I'm always trying to give advice, but actually my path was completely unplanned. And so it's super hard for me to say, oh, here's what I did, because it seems very random. But long story short, as you mentioned, I came from a little town called Steubenville, Ohio, on the West Virginia border. And I'd never really been anywhere. And I was lucky enough to get to go to Harvard. And a couple of things kind of changed my life there. One was I was studying economics, and I had a lecture by a professor that it turns out he's a legend in the world of developmental economics, but I didn't know anything. And he was talking about the rise of Japan after World War II. And I thought it was the most interesting lecture I'd yet attended. And I went up to him afterwards. It wasn't something I normally did. I said, Professor Rozovsky, that was so interesting. How do I do what you do? He said, you know, something like, it's a long road. So you're going to have to study, you know, some languages. So, you know, if you want to study Japan, you have to say Japanese, but you need to start with Chinese. It's kind of the base requirement. Mm. And you have to do a few years of this. And then you have to get a degree in economics and East Asian studies. Anyway, long story short, I enrolled immediately in intensive Chinese. I was terrible at languages. By the time I graduated, I was not very fluent at Chinese and barely scratched the surface on Japanese. And I needed to just take a little bit of time and you know, ramp up my abilities. So I moved to China for a year, what I thought was a year.
Yeah.
My girlfriend, who's now my wife, was a year behind me.
Okay.
So I had a year to kill. She was going to go to law school. I was going to come back, hopefully get into a PhD program. And that was the plan. But I arrived in China, and this is 92. And I thought, this is the most interesting thing I've ever seen in my life. And if we just go back and we spend the next, you know, 3 to 6 years in school,
yeah,
we're going to regret this.
Yeah.
And what my kids can't believe is then I had to persuade my wife via just letters that she should really come to China. And it was like 6 weeks to get a response. So I sent her a letter like, you know, we should really consider coming. And she said, I don't know, this seems like a big risk. Anyway, long story short, everything worked out great because BCG was setting up its office that year in Shanghai. I met the head of office. I eventually got hired to be part of the early associate team in Hong Kong and Shanghai. And one thing led to another. And so I started my career in China. And then when I left BCG, I started a small startup called China Now that ultimately failed. But it was a good experience to learn about what I didn't know. And then started another company that did payment processing, SmartPay, that ultimately did pretty well.
Yeah.
And so, that journey that sent me on the way all started with that one lecture. It was just kind of, a weird sliding door moment.
Yeah. Is there something about operating a business in China and the relentless pace sometimes that we see of Chinese innovation, or at least in the software world, that you take to, whether it was working with our mutual friend Kamakshi, or kind of working at Google? Like, are there lessons that you took from that experience that you brought to your career here in America?
Yeah, well, so there was some good and bad of all that time in China. So I was in China for 12 years, and it's what kind of formed my idea of how people should work.
Yeah,
for better or worse. And so my first kind of non-China job, I was the general manager for Real Networks for China, and then I came back to the States. It was a bit of a disaster in the sense that I was used to like going hard all the time. And I think people were just really, I mean, to put it very bluntly, I don't think anyone liked me. They're just like, this dude is just
tough culture fit.
Yeah, it was not a good fit. And thank goodness I like had one, as they say, first pancake that didn't come out quite right. And fortunately, when Google recruited me, these were a group of people that liked to move fast. And I was like, these are my people.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I'd also kind of softened some of my edges from like, the culture of China, which is very relentless.
Yeah.
And so it was a good chance for me to really learn how a good company should work in the US, but one that is still running hard.
Yep.
And still like being quite entrepreneurial. And so then jumping in with Kamakshi. So Kamakshi is one of the best entrepreneurs I think any of us will ever meet.
Yeah.
And she's deep domain expert. She, leads by example. She goes hard. And so to me, it was not, that much of a shock to my system. I was like, this is home cooking now. This is how you go. But we also took with us like some lessons from Google about like building things to scale versus just running as hard as you can. You also want to think through the whole platform and to build something that's solid and to last.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you're just running at a million miles an hour, you just don't stop to do those things. And so it's good to kind of take both. And so I think the lessons from China were always, it's better to go fast than to get every single thing right. And that's a big part of like, should be US startup culture.
Yeah.
But often because we grew up with companies that are concerned about headcount and budgets, we don't actually do that. In China, they really do. And so it's good to kind of take that seriously. But at the same time, I think what you learn more in the US culture is how to build things to really scale. And so build a solid foundation.
Yeah. It's one of the toughest kind of things for me to discern as an investor now, having done this at different firms for, I think, over a decade. You can love the founder and you can love the idea. It's sometimes hard to discern, are they willing to move at that pace, right?
Yeah.
And I have to remind founders sometimes, when you're taking venture capital, you're almost making a promise that you're going to 3x your growth by the time you raise that next round of capital.
Yeah.
That's the expectation you're setting with this money you're taking in.
Yeah.
Are you willing to commit the hours, the intensity, how you hire, who you hire, the culture you set?
Yeah.
And I don't know if every founder fully recognizes that when they go out and raise venture capital.
That's exactly right. It's an all-consuming life. It's not for everyone.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure people realize the extent to which it's so different.
Yeah.
And that the role of the founder is also very different from even that of the early employees who still have to go through some chaos.
Yeah.
But the weight of the world is on the founder's shoulders.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure even a founder necessarily appreciates that, but certainly I'm not sure VCs fully appreciate sometimes if they haven't done it themselves, just how difficult and stressful it is.
Yeah, yeah. So now to your journey as an investor, you've been at Foothill, well, the predecessor to Foothill, and we can talk about the kind of rebranding for over 6 years now.
Yeah.
What, you know, drew you to early stage investing? Because you've, you know, built companies from zero to, you know, a scale. You've worked at larger companies like Google and Palantir. Why was early stage investing the thing that excited you the most?
Yeah. So let me just take a step back and talk about where Foothill came from.
Yeah.
And it's in some ways a continuation of my personal story and super lucky and random. So when I arrived at Google, I first entered via the strategy team.
Yeah.
So it was called BizOps and Business Operations and Strategy.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. We were essentially like a little BCG within Google. And so our clients were the members of the Google executive team. And so it gave you a view of all of the different groups. So I got to know, you know, everyone from the heads of engineering. So like, you know, Alan Eustace and Jeff Huber and, you know, Jonathan Rosenberg and, you know, the folks that were running sales. And the person I worked with a lot was Patrick Pichette, the CFO, and just learned a lot about the way a really great company works. But after a few years of that, I moved into the product org and I was running a good part of the commerce organization. And one of my chief engineers is from China, and I had just spent my previous 12 years in China. And even though I was getting better at being like an American internet exec, still kind of my comfort zone, honestly, was with, you know, Chinese engineers.
Yeah.
And so Richard and I just hit it off, and the guy was amazing.
Yeah.
And he was part of this kind of Chinese Tsinghua University, which is often called the MIT of China or the IIT of China, Illuminati in the US. They had formed this club called TEEC, which stands for Tsinghua Entrepreneur Executive Club.
Yeah.
Which you could think of as a combination of alumni group and YPO. So a group of successful founders who all came from Tsinghua in the US.
Yep.
So that's what they were.
Yeah.
And they had started their own angel fund. Unbeknownst to them at that time, their angel fund was already a huge success. And when I say that, it's because they were the first institutional check into Zoom Video. They just didn't know that Zoom was going to become the big success it became.
This was the Qualcomm round or before that?
This is before that.
Before that, wow.
This is before that.
Yeah.
And so in that round, and so this is, and it's good to talk about this a little bit, because Eric Yuan talks about this a lot, and especially during his IPO roadshow. He said, you know, I got rejected by 50 VCs.
Yeah.
I knocked on everybody's door. And if you think about his business plan, is the world's simplest plan, which is WebEx is not very good. I built it. I know it's not very good, but I know how to build it way better this time.
Right.
You know, write me a small check and I could build something way better. And you would think that someone who was head of engineering for a company that exited for billions of dollars to Cisco, that everyone would line up to give him money.
Yeah.
But they didn't. And the only real explanation is that he just wasn't in the club. He had risen up through WebEx's offshore engineering group, and he was so good that they eventually brought him over to run all of engineering. But he hadn't gone to like Dartmouth with so-and-so's cousin and played lacrosse, and he's a good guy. And, like, nobody really knew what to make of him. But the folks from TEEC Angel Fund did. They're like, this guy's a fantastic engineer. We know him. And so if you look at the checks in that round, it was TEEC Angel Fund and the number of members of the Greater China community as largely individuals. So like Jerry Yang and Ken Xie, who founded Fortinet, Deng Feng, Bill Tai. And so they're all like well-known people, but they were acting as individuals. So anyway, so long story short, this TEEC Angel Fund was essentially investing in overlooked founders that happened to be immigrants.
Yep.
At that time, many of them were Chinese because that's where they came from. So I loved it. And so when Richard eventually approached me, said, hey, would you like to be an LP? I'd never invested in a fund before. But I said, that sounds amazing. I did an angel.
Yep.
And I knew the pros and cons. I really liked the thesis. So long story short, on first my bit of the journey was I had left, obviously, Google for Kamakshi and Drawbridge. That ended up having quite a successful exit. I had joined Palantir, which I loved, and I was running some product areas there. And this whole time, TEEC Angel Fund had been doing this amazing work. And eventually, some subset of the partners there decided to do an institutional fund. And I started talking to them. I said, you know, I think this is something I'd like to be part of.
Yeah.
And the early stage was because if you think about the people that we are focused on, like every fund has to have a mission. Every fund has to have something they do better than others.
Yeah.
What we thought we did better than others was identify overlooked talent early that is technical, that all my partners are PhDs in various technical disciplines. And so we felt our relative advantage is in identifying real talent that have found a real innovation before others realize it.
Yeah.
Once they have sales, then any spreadsheet monkey can, basically me when I was at BCG.
Sure,
I can go and make a spreadsheet and like figure out your cash flow. There's no shortage of people like me.
Yeah.
But there is a shortage of people who can dig in technically at the early stage and say, this is real and this is important. And so that's where we think we have the greatest source of advantage. And so early was where we wanted to be.
Yeah. So much to unpack there. I'll start with one of the earlier comments you made, which is about being in the club, right? Uh-huh. And as somebody who, again, I've spent my entire career here in New York, have seen the venture ecosystem evolve here. And yeah, over time, it was like, look, a handful of seed funds. And if you wanted to go raise your Series A, you got on a flight and you went to Silicon Valley. And now, obviously, I think it's changing. We're seeing more funds setting up New York offices. Yep. Great, VCs are spending 6 months of the year out here. The club obviously changes and it grows and the ecosystem grows. Is that statement still true that in order to go raise for your business today that you need to be in the club, or has it changed in the right way?
It's very interesting. Despite Silicon Valley investing in innovators and disruptors, the business is very old school. And it is around networks of people who know each other.
Yeah.
And if you ranked the top firms and you start at the very top with Sequoia, and I think that everyone will put them at the top of the list, and rightfully so, they are very much a network business, meaning they've backed terrific founders, and those founders can constantly refresh. And they're now investing in the next group, and they are able to go back to Sequoia Partners, who they trust, and say, hey, here's the next thing I'm working on. Would you like to do this? Or here's someone else I trust that came from my team.
Yeah.
So Kamakshi was like that. She was the chief data scientist at AdMob. Jim Goetz at Sequoia had backed them. He always felt that that was a business that had incredible talent. When she came out and wanted to start another business, of course she went to Jim. And, that's an unfair advantage. But it is an old school way of doing business. There are a number of new firms, and so some that you're very familiar with, like Signalfire, that are trying to disrupt that. And they said, what matters is data. There are great people all over the place, and we're going to build machines, just like the companies we invest in do.
Yeah.
And so they're going to mine the world of potential founders, potential companies, and look for signals of companies that would be doing great. And you would hope in that world that Eric Yuan would be someone that would have been identified as a real talent if you were looking at the right signals, a guy that can rise from running the offshore engineering team to running all of a multi-billion dollar exit company. If you built the model right, that would be a strong signal that this guy's special.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that things are changing, but it's the barbarians at the gate where the Signalfires of the world are trying with this new model to show that there is a different kind of data-driven source.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Sequoia's not staying still. They're also building in that respect. And so they are, also looking at how to build more kind of scalable machinery that can enhance the network. And we're very much of that view. We are comfortable as building systems that source programmatically because it's the background that myself and my fellow managing partners came from. We have much longer careers building software than we do as investors.
Yeah.
So we're very comfortable trying to build systems that break free from just the pure, like, who do you know model.
And to a degree, I would say, Eric, that's not a bad thing to be network driven because, one of the toughest thing for first time founders, when I was starting my career, really gravitated towards first time founders because that's who I knew, right?
Yep.
Now, some of those folks are coming back and they're building companies again and you get the opportunity to back somebody a second time. But early on, you know, the challenges that first-time founders I saw were having was just getting the right people in the door.
Yeah.
Convincing somebody really smart to come be your head of operations or your head of product or whatever it is. And so I can see it from the perspective of somebody like a Jim Getz or Sequoia, which is to say, we've backed them before. We know they can hire. We know they can scale a team. And we're willing to pay up a little bit in that second company or that third company because we've de-risked this person as an operator. When you are looking at a first-time founder that you're backing, what are some questions you're asking to try to de-risk them as an operator?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in fact, this is something you and I spoke a bit about this. I'm working at Columbia part-time with their technology ventures group.
Yeah.
And so those are all basically professors and postdocs that are thinking about starting businesses.
Mm.
And so in general, they don't have any work experience outside of the academic world.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a conversation that came up and it's something that we talk about a lot. And so we're generally looking, we're big believers that the past is not a bad predictor of the future. And so if you've been successful at every stop in your past, it is more likely that you'll also be successful in the future. And so when you're looking at someone that doesn't have a lot of work experience, but they were from an academic world, for example, did they attract the right grants? Did they get promoted to principal investigator, so PI? Mm. Did they run the lab? How well did the lab perform? Was their lab constantly a producer of cutting-edge research? How do you know that? And so you're looking for signals that they run hard. And that, you know, to the conversation we were having earlier, like that spirit of entrepreneurship can be shown even in other parts of life. The part that I think is more subtle is there are people who work hard and push themselves hard and always achieve, but the people around them aren't necessarily enhanced by their abilities. And so you want to find something that shows that when they pull a team together,
mm-hmm.
that they enhance the team or they even know how to pull mm-hmm. a team together. And so that's the part that I think you can always look on paper at how quickly they're promoted, how large was their group, how many papers they published, what the rankings were. But then figuring out how do they work as a team, I think is one of the harder things to tease out.
Yeah.
And we spend some time on that.
Yeah. It's always so tough. And I think it was especially tough in 2021 when you were meeting a founder and you had a week to decide whether you wanted to come in this deal. And, you know, I say this often on the show, so our listeners know this, but it's like a seed investor relationship lasts longer than the average American marriage.
Yes.
and you basically have a week to decide,
yes.
you know, if you met this person, do you like them enough? Do you want to sign up to be their board member for, you know, the coming decade, basically?
Yeah.
Are there things that you know, now I think as we look at more technical founders, deep tech founders, climate tech is becoming this thing. Are there specific things that you look for from these deep tech and climate founders that maybe are different from, let's say, traditional software founders that you're looking for?
So deep tech in general, the first question is, have they done something novel that is valuable?
Yeah.
And that statement does need to be parsed because it's important that what they're doing is actually hard to do and unique because that will be the basis for value in the business generally. But it's not enough. It has to actually be valuable to the world. Like there has mm-hmm. to be a real use. And you do find founders kind of slipping on both of those particular banana peels. Like the first where they're just working on something hard because that was the path to publishing. You know, they did something unique, but they don't know what it's applicable for or why.
Yeah.
Or on the flip side, they have a good business idea. It's an interesting idea, but it's not really defensible.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't really take advantage of their specialized knowledge. They're just trying to essentially build an execution play when that's not actually their strength. And so you do need to find founders that have a pretty good handle on both these things, that they do have a unique ability to create something that was hard for others, and that they have an idea of what difficult and valuable problem in the world this would solve.
Yeah.
In software in general, you're not doing something that is completely unique. It's very hard to, and there are exceptions to that.
Sure.
And especially these days with some of the deep learning applications take tremendous insight and research abilities. It's not just, you know, college dropouts. It's someone who's done like fundamental you know, years of research. But it's harder to find those examples in software than it is in like developing battery chemistry.
Yeah, Yeah. It's interesting to maybe synthesize what you're saying. You know, we talk a lot about product market fit. Mm-hmm. I think more and more we talk about founder market fit, but there's an aspect of founder product fit, right? That you're talking about here that maybe doesn't get talked about enough. This may be a great business for someone to build.
Yeah.
Are you the right person to build
it?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. And so we do like, so when we look at a company, we do start with just the product and just say, is this valuable? And was this something that, you know, because if it's just not, then there's no point of going any further. And so we spend a lot of time digging in. And to be honest, it is a little cyclical, which is that is where my partners come from.
Yeah.
So I'm the only non-PhD on the team.
You know, I noticed that on your website. I don't want to bring it up, but yeah, you are the only non-PhD out of your team.
Yeah. And so we do have a inclination to spend some time on the science.
Yeah.
Is this something that is somehow difficult? And is it a big problem they just solved? And if we conclude it is, then we're going to spend much more time than on the founder and then the market dynamic and the business side of things. But we do start by digging into, is this why you and why now? Why were you the person that could solve this?
Yeah.
Was it just a brilliant insight you had? Or was this a lot of incremental steps where a lot of people are working on this, a lot of people have this insight, it's a holy grail type of technology, but you little by little lever your way into solving this. And how'd that happen?
That's different, by the way, from a lot of seed funds, because when you speak to traditional seed funds, you know, sure, everybody talks about putting metrics around what they're investing in. And certainly I think as seed fund sizes have gotten larger, that becomes more important. But ultimately you're backing a person, right? You know, David Tisch would tell you it's all art, no science.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the way you're, I think, speaking about seed investing is, no, there is a fair amount of science. There is a fair amount of science to diligence here. We're seeing a lot more funds getting involved in deep tech and climate tech today that maybe don't bring the same level of expertise that Foothill does. How do you advise those funds when they're kind of wading into the deep tech world? What's some pitfalls?
Yeah. So to be fair, I'm not necessarily suggesting that what we're doing is the only way or even the correct way.
Yeah.
I think that every fund and every person needs to just be clear on who they are, what their identity is. And our identity is very much early stage technical. And as a result, you know, we lean heavily into that. What I would say, because my background is non-technical, and yet I've done a lot of our deals in like batteries and photonics. The secret to success, for me anyway, is pretty simple. It's two things. The first, we already invested in a lot of companies in these areas because we were Teak Angel Fund before.
Yep.
And we're focused on, and just to take a quick step, a bit of a diversion, the original Teak group was an angel fund where it's very much network-based.
Yep.
And so they're very much embedded in this group of Chinese immigrant technologists. So often they came here for PhDs, but they weren't peanut buttered across all departments. They weren't PhDs in like philosophy or English literature. They were here for pure math, chemistry, physics.
Yep.
And so as a result, our portfolio was much more skewed towards those worlds.
Yep.
And so if you think about it, it's the math people who are now doing transformer models. The chemistry people are now working on batteries. The physics people are working on semiconductors, or the material science people are working on several of these things. And so we had already in our portfolio a bunch of founders who came from that world. And so part number one is it's not really my partners and I doing a lot of this work. We do initial screen. Does this seem likely?
Yep.
But then we know, like, who you know is what you know.
You tap your network.
You tap the network.
Yeah.
So then for every battery deal that I now do, then Professor Yen Wang, who's the founder of Ascend Elements and the founder of AM Batteries, is the first person that I call. Darren Tan or Shirley Meng from UC San Diego. Yeah, there's a host of people that know a lot more than any of us.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't matter what the, you know, very narrow field is, even within this larger field, you're getting down to who knows about electrodes, who knows about electrolytes, who knows about separators. Eventually you have a group around you that you can rely on. So part number one is if you're not in that tech world, there are a lot of people out there who are. And you know, a lot of times they're quite eager to interact with early stage venture and share what they know.
Yep.
And they're also interested to see what we see. And then part two is you have to find the other investors who you know through experience know what they're doing. I'll just be very direct about this. The folks from TDK Ventures, Anzu Partners, FSV, so Fine Structure Ventures, Zora, so Phil Inagaki is mm-hmm. like one of the best individual investors I've met anywhere. In New York, I've had Fange, Chris from Material Impact.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you meet someone who really knows what they're doing, it's gold.
Yeah.
And so the combination of other founders who are in the field and then other investors who are quite deep, will take you pretty far. So you develop your own firm's capabilities, but your own firm capability is your ability to make quick triage decisions.
Yep.
And then knowing a network that you can bring in for expertise. And then finally, this group of trusted co-investors. And it does go both ways. Like it's not, I would hope that they would also trust me and want to work with me.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have to kind of pull your weight when mm-hmm. you're working with them and you get to join a board with one of them. But they say, yeah, actually, if Eric's here, he puts his back into it and he can bring something to the table. But eventually you have to form that network of trusted relationships.
Yep.
And so in the deep tech world, the thing that I would say is a little different is there does have to be some people that do understand the technology and they have to understand that it's differentiated and it should work.
Yeah, I like the kind of differentiated technology and then also scalability, right? Yeah. And you're kind of evaluating both as you're going out to your network to make sure it fits both. And then the third piece obviously comes back to what we talked about. The founder then has to match that this is a great business and they're the right founder to build it. As you're advising these founders, is there a hire that deep tech or technical founders you wish they made sooner that they don't do soon enough?
So I actually wrote a blog post about part of this. It is called The Case for BizOps Early. So I actually, it's a little bit of a bias where I was at the BizOps group at
yep.
Google. I think that there's a role for a person that came out of like the consulting environment where they're very, very good at context switching. They can do anything. And just plug holes. Because what often happens is the core technical team hires all engineers. And then eventually they say, oh, we're ready for business now. And they want to hire a salesperson or a BD person. But actually, it's not ready for sales or BD. Their product is very nascent. Someone's going to just have to figure a lot of things out. And if you're a real salesperson, then probably you've had a well-defined product to work with. And that can be very frustrating. On the flip side, most of these PhD founders have never worked with a salesperson before, a BD yeah. person before. And so it's very frustrating on both sides. What they actually need is someone that has the ability to jump on lots of problems and get up to speed quickly and probably get a bunch of things kicked off for them,
yeah.
build the process, and that when they're ready to hire someone who's a professional domain expert, that person is well leveraged.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people underappreciate that role of like the, a little bit of a jack of all trades, but they probably do come from that background where they were at a McKinsey or BCG or worked in BizOps early. But the other thing, there's a big difference between a chief scientist and a head of engineering.
Mm.
And so a lot of the firms that we've backed, the person who, because we're looking for a true innovation, they're often a scientist. And they are great at doing some fundamental research and work in the lab. But that's different from the person who's going to build something that becomes a product.
Yeah.
And there's a gap between those two people. And often the person who's the chief scientist also thinks that they're the chief engineer. And they've just never done it before. And so they haven't seen what someone who runs an engineering group at a company can do. And so that's something where we often have to coach the founders on what the first engineering hires look like, because they're used to hiring for the lab who are great people, are great researchers.
Yep.
But there's a transition that takes place when someone's going to build a product that is going to be usable by a third party.
Yeah. When it comes to that BizOps hire, again, if you are a scientist, you're coming from a lab setting, you probably never hired a BizOps
yeah.
person, right? What are some ways to discern if this is the right person? If you know, there's a founder listening right now building in mining and, you know, they're satellite mining's, you know, scientist, engineer. Like, how do they know that this BizOps person is kind of the right, person?
So there's two ways to look at this. First is if it's after you've gotten your VCs on board, this is one where you make the VCs do some work.
Yeah.
And so the VCs should be out front interviewing because many of the VCs came from the same background. This is where a lot of VCs had that experience earlier in their life of some kind of strategic management. And so they have some sense for, you know, who's a bullshitter and who does real work and how would you know, what kind of personality are you looking for? What kind of experience and trajectory are you looking for? If it's before that, if you're thinking, I want to start a company, and I'm a scientist, I have other scientist friends, do we want someone who's going to think about the whole business side of things? How would I find that person? I think the good news is there are a lot of those kinds of people that are looking to find actual scientists. Mm. And so all like great business schools, so if you're coming out of an academic environment, in general, the folks on the business side of the house are quite willing to consult with you and sort of to try before you buy.
Yeah.
Do they actually work? Are they just there to give opinions or they can roll up their sleeves and like do stuff? And I think that's, you know, the main requirement for me is someone who is, you know, low ego, high bias for action, and is smart enough to be able to do good work. They've been well-trained, but it is that personality. They're willing to do anything. And they're willing to actually do anything, not just... Yeah. You know, think
By the way, I find founders screw up so often because they go for title. So they go, well, I need marketing, right? Or I need something on commercialization. I'm going to go hire a CMO.
Yeah.
And you go hire a CMO and you go get them from a great brand name.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe they're switching careers. They want something a little more fast paced, whatever. They're going to come work for you. This is a CMO that has had a 12-person team under them that, you know, does the dashboards and does the analytics and, you know, they whiteboard solutions and then somebody goes and executes on it.
Yeah.
And the number one thing I think as a startup founder, I advise my founders to be like, ask the question like, hey, you are our entire marketing department. Yes. Top to bottom, you're the analyst, you're the associate, you're the director, you're the MD. You're doing all of it top to bottom. And if that person is not scared off by that, then okay, maybe that's the right thing. Because oftentimes, even if you know, with best intentions go, hey, when we close our Series A, we're going to set aside some, you know, allocation to go hire you a team. If that doesn't happen for a while, you've got a pretty unhappy, you know, team member because they're doing stuff that they're not really designed to do. So I always find this as like a bad hire early on can really, you know, hamstring a company.
Yeah, it drags everybody down. It's very unpleasant for everybody involved. It's bad for the person coming in who really thought that they were going to, you know, it's a big risk to a seasoned executive.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of seasoned executives, they don't realize it's been so long since they were an individual contributor and they don't realize that maybe those muscles have atrophied or they're just not what they are skilled at anymore.
Yeah.
And they start feeling like this is ridiculous. You know, I should be leveraged. I should have like a team and then I could do this stuff. And they're frustrated. The CEO is frustrated. And it just drags everybody down.
Yeah.
Whereas like getting a low ego, talented person can often fill a lot of gaps until you're ready to bring in an executive with a small team.
Yep.
That they can actually leverage.
Yeah.
So I think that that's really critical. I have like just a small example that I think
should make this
specific. And I can't praise this person enough. But it's one of the reasons that I mentioned Anzu's great. So Anzu Partners is a great deep tech firm based in San Diego. We've co-invested on a few things, but one of them is called AM Batteries. AM Batteries, I think, is going to become one of the most important companies in the battery world. So this is dry electrode manufacturing.
Hmm.
The CEO is named Yen Wang. He's a professor at Worcester Polytech. And he was also the inventor and founder of Ascend Elements, which is called Battery Resourcers. So it's one of North America's largest battery recyclers and is now a $1.5 billion company. And so he knows what he's doing and he's an incredibly good scientist. But Ascend Elements was not a linear road. They had, they had their ups and downs like many startups. And through that experience, he kind of realized what he does well and where he needs help. And so when we met him with his new company, it was literally just he and another professor, Hung Pan, and a paper they wrote that seemed very promising. And so it took a lot of time to sort of understand how valuable and important is this. We had to bring in, you know, a lot of help. But once we decided to pull the trigger, you know, he was quite good at recognizing he needs a real engineer, and he hired a great one. And we were starting to scale the company. They're hitting their technical milestones incredibly well. Anzu Partners comes in. Anzu Partners has a up-and-coming investor named Josh Stilling. Mm-hmm. And Josh is, you know, he's an MBA, but he's also technical. And eventually he put his hand up and said, you know, I'm going to join AM Batteries part-time to help them with all of these business processes and their first BD stuff. And he's immediately after injecting himself, the whole cadence of the company changed.
Wow.
And so everything from marketing programs and PR to their relationships with third party, customers to, you know, a lot of ideas around additional business lines, like started cropping up and moving forward. And it's the power of a person who just has that attitude and that training. And so I feel like injecting the right person at the right time. And of course, everyone had the advantage of already knowing Josh because he had already been sitting in all our board meetings. We knew how good he was. So that's a little bit of an unfair example that, you know.
No, but there's trust there, right? And
so it's just a good example of like the impact. Like he's not the guy who's going to invent these technologies.
Yeah.
He's also, if you just hired a full-time BD person, that person would very quickly, I think, struggle with a company of that scale and that maturity. Mm-hmm. But someone with Josh's smarts, technical chops, and ability to kind of context switch and very quickly get to speed in many things has made a world of difference.
Yeah.
And you could see the company velocity increasing, you know, dramatically.
Well, I love that example. And I think it also highlights choosing your investors carefully as a founder, right?
Yeah.
If you are building something in deep tech, in certain aspects of climate tech, I know not everything in climate tech is deep tech, but if you're building in that category, choosing your investor and seeing that they have folks on their team that can slot in or even spend a day with you a week to kind of work through these issues before you can hire for them can make a world of difference for you. Because ultimately, as a founder with not that much money raised, you're trying to get as much leverage as you can.
Yeah.
And if you can tap your investors for some of that leverage, I mean, that's what, you know, we're supposed to be here for. Other than just the check, we're here for you know, be able to give some leverage. So I love that example. You know, we've been dancing around this idea, and I wanted to make sure I cover it before we wrap today. Are we having a moment in deep tech? Like, why now? I'm seeing so much excitement.
Yeah.
What is this deep tech moment?
Yeah, it's a great question. I love this topic. And I strongly believe that we're at the very early stages of a deep tech boom. And, you know, when you think about when VCs have record-breaking funds, it's normally because there was a big discontinuity in a big market. And so you think about the rise of search or e-commerce or social media. You know, those are when the legendary kind of fortunes were made. But none of those are that technical. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the founders of Google were PhD students, but all of those examples were more kind of applications. Versus a really fundamental science breakthrough. You know, Silicon Valley was born on science breakthroughs. So Fairchild Semiconductor, then, you know, networking companies and Genentech. So all of these were deep tech.
Yeah.
But then for a while, we've gone through like a number of waves of application riches. I do think we're finally coming full circle and we're coming to a major deep tech revolution. And there's forces that are causing this across a number of areas. So AI is changing everything and deep learning is changing everything. And like I said, the people who are starting these companies are not, you know, I mentioned e-commerce, Jeff Bezos was a quant trader. Obviously Facebook, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is a brilliant, you know, CS dropout.
Yeah.
The people who are starting these companies did research. So people are starting the top deep learning companies. We're doing mathematics, you know, information theory. Yeah, these were PhD level researchers. Now, because of the preponderance of AI, you have pressure on the data centers. And so that's causing a gold rush on the next generation AI chip. Yeah. So we've invested in D-Matrix, which is booming, another company called Tetramem. And so there's a number of companies that are going for this prize of the next generation data center. And then you fix compute, and then you run into another logjam with the transferring of data between, you know, chiplets and between data centers. Mm-hmm. And so then you have these photonics companies that are coming about, and we've invested in Hyperlight and Quintessent. And so there's this wave effect that happens that the solution to each of these problems is a discontinuity. And so $1 trillion of like datacom investment is now has to get upgraded. Because we're putting so much pressure on these networks with the amount of data that needs to get processed.
Yeah.
But similarly, you have the same thing on the climate tech side. Your grid was not built for all of us having EVs, right? And now you're going to electric boats, you know, electrification of everywhere. And so now you need new grid technologies. Yep. So we just announced an investment in a solid-state transformer company. We're looking—
That's Ampersand, right?
That's Ampersand.
Really interesting. Yeah.
And again, like I said, I have Phil Nagaki from Zora to really thank for that. And then this is what allowed me to meet Material Impact. And so same thing. We believe that the electrification of everything is kind of inevitable and that there's components now that need to get upgraded as you— You know, if you think about the downstream implications of all of EV adoption, then you can see very large markets and very old markets that now need to get upgraded. And so we identified a number of very large, you know, quote, $1 trillion markets, which is not that easy to find, that are undergoing a major disruption.
Yeah.
And we said, you know, this is real. Now, just one more word about it. Part of the reason why people are skeptical is in 2008, there was a big wave of clean tech investing in particular.
The Vinod Khosla, Clean Tech One.
That's right.
You know, wave, yes.
And that was, you know, I think it was, you know, based on a pretty good hypothesis, which is, you know, if you look at the price of oil going up and the ability, so the cost per you know, kilowatt hour of batteries going down and the capacity going down, you'd say eventually these two lines will cross and across a lot of things. So not just batteries, but also solar and wind, and that there'd be a sea change in a $1 trillion industry. So it's not a crazy bet. But of course, you had war breakout, you had a recession, price of oil plummeted. So a lot of these assumptions that people were looking at when they said this is time to make some big bets turned out to be incorrect.
Yeah.
What's different today is that these things are now happening. It's not a, you know, Mary Meeker chart where you're saying, ah, if you look at this trend line, you continue off in the future, then 3 years from now, of course, the world's going to look different.
Yeah.
You don't need to project anymore.
Yeah.
This has happened. The, you know, EV total cost of ownership for a given car model is now lower than comparable ICE car. And so it no longer makes sense for your next car, just from a total cost of ownership perspective. You can have other reasons, like you have range anxiety. There might be a reason that you don't want to buy an EV. But from just a pure cost standpoint, we've crossed that threshold.
Yeah, we've hit parity, if not even cheaper than, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's happened across a number of areas where there's no longer, like, we don't need to wonder, is there going to be a killer AI app? You know, the day GPT-3 launched, you know, all of us were stunned. And the world's different.
Yeah.
And so there's no longer this speculation around, are we just around the corner? We're around the corner.
Yeah.
So now it's a matter of thinking about the implications of being around the corner and what are all the downstream things that need to start changing. And that's where I think a lot of the really interesting opportunities lie.
Yeah, I love the articulation there. And I think it's so interesting to talk about. You know, I always think of major innovations coming off of platform shifts. So the shift from you know, kind of on-prem to cloud, or the shift from desktop to mobile. But to think about it from actually even a layer deeper on the infrastructure layer, creating new applications, right? The shift from desktop to mobile created all of these ride-hailing apps and Airbnb and sort of thing. And now you can only imagine the shift to wide-scale adoption of AI, right?
Yes.
You have GPT in our pocket.
Yes.
What does that actually unlock for us at the application layer? We certainly have a lot more investors investing at the application layer.
Right.
Than we do at the infrastructure layer. So if you're a founder building at that scale, the capital is out there for you, right? That's the interesting thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so we get this question all the time from our LPs. They said, you know, yes, you guys have always been interested in deep learning AI, but aren't the valuations just like prohibitive
for
a stage investor?
Yeah.
And for many types of companies, that's absolutely true. Like, we're not going to be investing in the next foundation model. And there's certainly, you know, a lot of kinds of applications where it doesn't look like a seed round investment.
Yeah.
And also doesn't really match us. Those are
like a $10 million first check, right? Right. You're like, okay.
and it falls outside. You know, a lot of these are just applying technology that's already been created. So it doesn't really fit us well.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you go down the other direction and say, what's happening in the infrastructure? If all these things happen, then what supports this? That fits us really well. Mm. And so now, you know, I mentioned Quintessent. Quintessent is a company from UC Santa Barbara. Out of John Bowers lab. So John Bowers is kind of a legendary photonics and optics professor who's founded 5 companies. Mm-hmm. So this is a guy who does have, you look at, is the past a good indication of the future? World-class researcher, one of the world's experts in his field that also knows how to bring something from the lab to the market. So this is one of his postdocs, Alan Liu, along with other investors. So Alex Fong from Entrada Ventures, who got his PhD in optics photonics out of John Bauer's lab. So this is the perfect co-investor for this. And Ben Yu from Sierra Ventures, who also has a PhD in photonics. So we went in together with this company that is going to basically make the comb laser and connections to dramatically speed up the interconnections between chips and resolve the bottleneck for AI. It's incredibly important and it's huge.
Yeah.
But you're not talking about the kind of valuation that you're getting for, you know, Harvey, a legal app, which is an amazing application, which will hopefully make lots and lots of money. But it's at a completely different layer of the problem. Yeah. And so I think fewer people are concentrating on that layer of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very fair to say. So Eric, this has been a wonderful dive into all things deep tech. I'd love to close with you where we close with all of our guests. You know, beginning of 2024 here, we're coming off of a year in the venture market, which was slower, tougher to raise money. Goalposts were shifting. And then at the same time on the climate tech side, there continues to be some doom and gloom around how quickly, you know, we're actually moving forward. So in the face of kind of all of this gloom, what is something that still excites you and keeps you optimistic as you're finding and backing great founders every day?
It's a great question. I get, you know, sometimes I feel overwhelmed with like the doom and gloom and wow, the scale of problems is so large. You brought up Vinod Khosla a moment ago. I think he's one of the most fascinating speakers on this subject. He's very much a techno-optimist. Mm-hmm. But one of his things, which I think is fundamentally right, is our brains struggle to understand exponential improvements. And so GPT-3 that I mentioned blew our minds. It shouldn't have, but it's because we don't understand exponential improvement. We look at the pace of improvement of various AI bots, and we tend to project in a linear fashion. So when something comes up that is orders of magnitude better than the previous iteration, like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
But that is the way a lot of technology is built. And so he talks about, well, you know, in the world of climate, fusion is going to happen. Doesn't know exactly when, but if Vinod said, you know, if you say 30 years, yeah, almost certainly. 20 years, maybe.
Yeah.
But then it's like free energy.
within our lifetime.
Within our lifetime.
Yeah.
And so these are massive step changes that are very hard for our brains to fully grasp. And so my optimistic side is that there's now an accepted moment in the world of, you know, climate investing that this is real. This is no longer speculative where only the brave are going. So the Khoslas and John Doors of the world were brave. And, you know, on some things they got a bit burned, but they were the brave vanguard. Today, you don't have to be that brave to go in this world. It's here.
Yeah.
And so the scale of support is large. Combined with the exponential nature of improvement, I'm pretty optimistic that a lot of the solutions to our problems are there. There's someone who's working on it right now.
Yeah.
And for the first time, they're actually getting attention. And I think that that's a big change from the past.
Yeah, well, I'll speak to the attention piece because obviously, you know, so much of what we do at VSC is really around helping founders, especially technical founders, building in, you know, industrial automation, legacy industries, get attention. it's becoming more and more talked about. You know, we had a company in the laundry space that got a feature on CNBC. I mean, how often do some people think about these hidden economies, you know, all around us every day? There's a laundromat on every corner. We don't think about it. And now I think more and more we're starting to see, what's the energy impact of that? Is it good for me to have my dry cleaning done here? Is there a better way, the more eco-friendly way for it to be done? I love that as consumers, we're having those conversations. And I think the press is catching up to say, people care about that. They care about the cars around them, the public transportation around them, the world around them. And ultimately, if you're a technical founder building in those spaces, they're getting attention. And I think that's a really beautiful thing. So I'll wrap with you there, Eric. This was so fun. I'm so glad that we got to do this in person. And I'm excited to have you back on the show we can do this
again. Thank you so much for having me. Anytime.
This was great. Thank you. Well, that's it for this week's episode of Climb by VSC. Thank you so much for watching and listening. Thanks to my guest, Eric Rosenblum from Foothill Ventures, for joining me on the show today. Hey, did you know that you can watch as well as listen to full episodes of Climb? Head on over to YouTube and subscribe to watch episodes every single day and clips that we post literally every day. Lots of clips on there. You can also follow us on social, on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Instagram. We're not hard to find. If you enjoy this episode, we'd love for you to leave us a 5-star review on Spotify and Apple. And if you love this episode, please send us some guests that we should have on the show. We'd love to have them. Well, that's it for now. We'll see you next week on Climb by VSC.